¡Viva la raza!
If you're not cheating, you're not trying.
We lie, we cheat, we steal. We lie, we cheat, we steal.
Mamacita, we got that passion that's lasting long. Mujeres, fall in love with that Latin charm. One woman isn't enough, amigo. Siempre cogiendo más mujeres porque somos Latino. And we're tougher than tough, calling your bluff, cuz.
We lie, we cheat, we steal. We lie, we cheat, we steal.
We don't care if you like us. Everybody wants to fight us.
Sound off 134 here on SCScoops.com. It is Sunday, November 14th, 2010. Solid Monster here with you on a somewhat somber weekend as we commemorate the five-year anniversary of the death of one Eddie Guerrero, one of the greatest performers who ever set foot inside a wrestling ring, former WWE champion, of course. And it was 5 years ago yesterday that Eddie was found dead in a Minneapolis hotel room. He was in Minnesota the day of what would have been a SmackDown taping that would have seen him most likely win his second WWE championship. He was slated to participate in a triple threat main event that would have involved Batista and Randy Orton. And, yeah, there's been some WWE writers themselves that have come out in interviews since then and said, oh, well, you know, Eddie was not going to win the title, even though all signs seem to point to that happening. I tend to believe that that, in fact, is not true. And unless plans change at the very last minute, I believe Stephanie McMahon may have actually been on the phone with Eddie the night before telling him that he was to win the world championship. So, in any event, all of that is irrelevant in light of what actually ended up happening, of course. And, you know, Eddie was the classic story of somebody who never should have been as big as he was. You know, here's a guy who was immensely talented, came from a wrestling family, the likes of which, like a Hart family or a Von Erich family, the Guerreros are one of the more renowned wrestling families of all time. It was in his blood. It was part of his pedigree. He was a luchador. He was a cruiserweight in WCW, and you know, for the most part, was an entertaining mid-card act in WWE his first several years, former Intercontinental Champion, one of the workhorses of the company, but I don't think was somebody that people certainly higher up in WWE ever saw as a main event player. But he worked his ass off, proved himself worthy of it, and of course, that match at the Cow Palace in 2004 where he beat Brock Lesnar to become champion. I just watched that again on YouTube yesterday. And just a phenomenal match. And again, you had a story there that you really, it's hard, those are hard to come by these days. You know, Eddie had been in the business for so long. And, you know, this was a really, really, really big deal to him. And they happened to be in San Francisco, I guess it would have been, which has a big, you know, Latin population, and the fans were behind him, and just a huge pop for the win, a lot of emotion that night, one of the best championship matches really that you'll ever see, and the big celebration afterwards, and even the big celebration on SmackDown that week when he came out of the crowd, the big confetti celebration. I think that was actually one of the top 50 greatest SmackDown moments listed on the SmackDown Best Of DVD. But he was a one-of-a-kind performer who truly broke through the glass ceiling and proved that he was worthy of being a main event guy. You know, he had to do, in his mind, he had to do certain things along the way that I wish he had not have done. I mean, again, if you look at Eddie Guerrero physically in 2005, when he died, compared to Eddie Guerrero of 2000, or Eddie Guerrero of 1997. You can just tell the physical differences in the old Eddie Guerrero to the new one. You know, the guy was on roids. He was on the gas. And, you know, he was not a very big guy to begin with. He was not a very tall guy. You know, I look at pictures of him, and it's just amazing to me. It's really no wonder his heart gave out, quite frankly. I have no doubt in my mind that's ultimately what caused him to pass away at such an early age. I mean, your body, your frame can only support so much weight and so much punishment. He was not meant to be as ripped and as big as he was. And it was a shame, but again, in his short life, he certainly accomplished more than most guys, I think, in wrestling will when they reach the age of 38. And he got inducted into the Hall of Fame a couple of months later. In 2006, of course, his wife Vicky has become an integral part of WWE television. A couple of weeks ago, the news that his 20-year-old daughter Shawl has signed a contract with the company to head to developmental and begin her career, I guess, as a diva. So the Guerrero legacy lives on. Eddie will go down as one of the greatest performers of this or any generation. And this weekend, we reflect back on his life and legacy and smile. Now, before we move on here, I just want to mention, in case I sound any different, which I might, after I did the show last week, I think I might have posted about this on Twitter and Facebook, but almost, well, I shouldn't say immediately, several hours after I recorded episode 133 last weekend, I started to feel a little unlike myself. And basically what ended up happening was I guess I must have had the flu, which had not fully manifested itself while I was doing the podcast last week, although I must have gotten it a couple of days before. And that night, it certainly hit me like a ton of bricks. And I've been battling this beast all week. I'm still not 100%. I don't know when the hell this is going to go away. It is not fun having the flu. My first time with it, so I've been very fortunate up until this point. But yeah, not a good week for the Sala Monster, but soldiering on nonetheless. So again, if I sound a little weird, that would be why. Just bear with me here. Now, before we get into anything else, I figure I may as well address this because I've got a couple of comments about this here. And what I'm referring to are the top 50 WWE superstars of all time. Now, for those of you who don't know, WWE has a new DVD coming out, I believe next month, that essentially is their version of their own top 50 list of the greatest superstars of all time. I don't yet know the full format of the DVD. I would imagine that it'll simply be a collection of the best matches and moments of the people on this top 50 countdown. And for months, people have been speculating what this list would look like. I mean, this was going to be a controversial list no matter what, because everybody has their own idea of who should be in the top 10 and who should be number 1. And, you know, what does it mean if somebody is listed below 30? You know, is that a slap in their face? Is it politics? This was not going to be a list that would please everybody. Now, I gave them the benefit of the doubt and figured the right people would make the top 10. You know, even if, for example, Hulk Hogan, for example, was not number 1 on the list, I trusted them enough that even though Hogan is with TNA, he's, you know, back on bad terms, I guess, because of that with them, that Hogan would certainly make the top 5. Because if this is a listing of the top 50 WWE superstars of all time, and again, what the criteria is for best of all time is not made clear. Are they referring to work rate? Probably not. Are they referring to you know, person who sold the most tickets and popped the biggest ratings? I'm sure it's a little bit of everything, but they don't make that criteria clear. So, again, this list is certainly subjective. They don't make the list of criteria clear at all. So let me just throw that out there first and foremost. But again, I trusted they would do the right thing in terms of putting the right people in the top 10, whatever their final position was. And so when you think of the top 50 of all time, at least when it comes to WWE, you think of Hulk Hogan, you think of Steve Austin, you think of The Rock, Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, The Undertaker, I think of Kurt Angle. You know, you think of those names, Randy Savage. And begrudgingly, I'd probably have to throw John Cena in that list too, because, you know, at this point, Cena has been the face of the company now. He has been on top in the main event for several years now. World champion 9 times over. Cena has earned his spot. He is the Hulk Hogan of this generation. Instead, what we have here with this list is an utter embarrassment. Now, let me just say that when I saw the list put up on SE Scoops, it looks like this list that's floating around was submitted by one person who supposedly had gotten a sneak peek at the DVD. I'm still not 100% sure that this list is entirely accurate. It looks like it is, but let me just throw that out there, the possibility that this list is a fake. So if it is a fake and I spend the next 20 minutes arguing about it, then, you know, too bad for me. But just wanted to throw that out there because I have not seen, multiple people submitting this, proving that they have in fact seen the list. And, as with everything on the internet, take it with a grain of salt. But if this is in fact the list, I say shame on WWE. Because clearly they just did not give a fuck when they put this thing together. So let's run through this list here. We're going to start with their version of the top 10 greatest superstars of all time. Top 10. Number 1, Shawn Michaels. Hard to argue. I can't really knock them for that. Again, would I have put Shawn Michaels in the number 1 position? Probably not. Would I have put him in the top 3? Maybe. More likely the top 5. Again, if I'm thinking top 3 all-time WWF, just based upon, the period that I grew up as a fan, you'd have to have Hogan, Austin, and Hogan, Austin, Bruno even. Bruno probably should be in that top 3. Even if Bruno was before the generation of many people listening here, Bruno Sammartino was kind of a big deal. World champion for 8 years straight. Numerous legitimate sellouts at Madison Square Garden, which was their big home base back in the day. It still is, but, MSG does not mean, the MSG shows don't mean nearly as much as they once did, nor do they go back there as often. Shawn Michaels is easily the greatest performer in the history of WWE. And when you think of Mr. WrestleMania, which is kind of the moniker that he's picked up, he really is Mr. WrestleMania if you look at it. More often than not, he will steal the show at WrestleMania, and he can literally save an entire card with his match. And I know Undertaker has the streak, but Shawn Michaels is probably the biggest game-time performer that they have ever had. And he's had more great matches with more people than anybody else in the company. Again, he started out as a small tag team wrestler. He branched out on his own. He made his mark. He became the Intercontinental Champion. He was a great mid-card talent. He worked his way up to the main event. He busted his ass. And I cannot think of another person who has truly had the tale of two careers. Shawn Michaels really had a part one and a part two. It was kind of the Shawn Michaels BC and the Shawn Michaels AD. His first career ended in 98 with the back injury. His second career started with that street fight with Triple H in 02. People thought it was just a one-time comeback, and then it turned into, I could do one more match, and then I could do one more, and then he was back full-time. And Shawn Michaels is really the missing ingredient these days on Raw. The company is really worse off not having him on their active roster anymore, but I cannot think of a guy that has given more to WWE than Shawn Michaels. So I don't have a problem with them putting him at number one. That's fine. He would not have been number one on my list, but I accept that. That's fine. Number two is The Undertaker. Again, Undertaker is certainly one of the greatest performers the company has ever seen. There is nobody on the active roster who has more tenure than he does as far as an active performer. And it's the greatest gimmick, certainly, that Vince McMahon has ever conceived of in his life. Undertaker has had some fantastic matches as well. Fortunately, he seems to be falling apart these days. Would he have been number two on my list of all-time greats? Absolutely not. But whatever, I can accept that. Michaels and Undertaker, you can argue their exact position, but they're certainly top 10 worthy performers. I'm not going to bitch about that. Steve Austin is listed at number 3. He should probably be number 1. If not number 1, then number 2. But again, that's fine. Bret Hart at number 4. Bret was certainly always a workhorse. He told great, great stories in his matches. He has been part of some of the greatest matches in company history. Quite frankly, wherever Michaels is on this countdown, I think Bret would either have to be one spot in front of him or one spot behind him. Their two careers are so heavily interlinked. If they're not tied on the list, they have to be within one position of each other. So if you're going to put Michaels at number one, you should have put Bret at number two, or vice versa, but whatever. Rock is listed at number five. No argument here. And here's where it gets a little weird. You have Harley Race at number six. Explain to me why the fuck Harley Race is number six on a top 50 greatest superstars of WWE countdown. Now, mind you, we're talking WWE. Now, even if we were not talking WWE, Harley Race would not be anywhere near number six on my list. Why is he behind The Rock? Why is he ahead of names like Hogan and San Martino and Savage and Flair? Can somebody explain that to me? Harley Race was a fucking joke in WWE. He came in, he had shitty matches, they put a fucking crown and robe on him, and quite frankly, he had all of what? 2 years maybe in the company? He wasn't even there that long before he ultimately left and then later retired. Just fucking atrocious that he would even be in that top 10. Ricky Steamboat? Now, no offense to Ricky Steamboat, he's a great performer. But again, if we're talking WWE, Steamboat does not deserve to be in the top 10. He had a great match with Savage at WrestleMania 3, one of the greatest of all time. He won the championship, but lost the championship, what, 3 months later, took some time off, was punished because of that. Of course, the story there is Steamboat requested time off shortly after WrestleMania due to, I guess, to either the recent birth or upcoming birth of his son. Vince McMahon was none too happy about this because they had built up Steamboat for so long, given him the Intercontinental title, now you want time off. So he got his time off, he dropped the belt to the Honky Tonk Man, and he was basically on Vince McMahon's shit list from that point forward. Steamboat's time in WWF, when you really add it up, I mean, he was there, God, I mean, he must have come in 85, was there through 88, left, had that great program with Flair in 89 in the NWA, came back in 91, and was gone by 92. So again, his time in WWF was very limited, and aside from that WrestleMania 3 victory, he didn't do much. Not top 10 material. Andre the Giant comes after Ricky Steamboat, which actually shocks the hell out of me. I figured they would put Andre higher than that. Rey Mysterio, and then Rowdy Roddy Piper rounds out the top 10. Let me just say this. Rey Mysterio is a phenomenal performer. Rey Mysterio achieved far greater success in WWE than he did overall in WCW. I will say that. But when I think of Rey Mysterio as an in-ring performer, quite frankly, I think his best days were in WCW. Now, again, we don't know what the criteria is for this list. It's not strictly work rate. You know, again, we're talking WWE here. But I don't look at Rey Mysterio as being in the top 10 of all time in WWE. I don't see it. I don't see it. Now, if they would have put John Cena in that slot, no problem. I could totally understand that. Put John Cena at number 9 instead of Rey Mysterio, no problem. I get that. But Rey Mysterio ahead of guys like Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Mick Foley, Bruno said, I don't understand that at all. So that's your top 10, and then you move on, and it gets even worse. Now, remember now, we went through the top 10 here. I did not mention the name Hulk Hogan. I did not mention the name Randy Savage. I did not mention the name Ric Flair. I did not mention the name Bruno Sammartino. I did not mention the name Terry Funk. Although, again, Funk would not have been in my top 10 either, but let's see here. Number 11, we have Eddie Guerrero, who we just talked about. Number 12, we have Triple H. The only thing that shocks me about that is that he wasn't in the top 10. Number 13, Gorgeous George. Can somebody please explain that one to me? I mean, I know that they're going to be making a Gorgeous George movie. Why the fuck he is number 13 on this list? Did Gorgeous George ever even wrestle for the WWWF? He might have. It's possible. I'm not saying he didn't, but I certainly don't recall. Randy Savage, finally. Kurt Hennig. John Cena. Ric Flair. And Dusty Rhodes apparently are tied at number 17. Talk about a slap in the fucking face. Ric Flair at number 17 and tied, no less, with Dusty Rhodes. Yeah. WWE does not hold a grudge or anything like that. Edge is number 18. Remember that, because we still haven't mentioned Hogan. Jerry Lawler. Jerry Lawler. Let me talk about Jerry the King Lawler here. Jerry the King Lawler has had a very successful career in professional wrestling. Over 35 years. Most, if not all, of his success came in the Memphis territory, which most of the time, if not all of the time, he was booking. And don't get me wrong, Lawler is a tremendous performer. His facials, his promo ability, he's not a great in-ring performer, but certainly he's a good wrestler. But in WWE, he was always a joke. Only in the last decade or so, when he is booked to wrestle, or booked in an angle, is he booked as a serious babyface that people can get behind. When he came into the World Wrestling Federation in 1992, it was as an announcer slash wrestler, but he was booked as a fucking joke. Lawler was the biggest chicken shit heel you've ever seen. He was booked to look like nothing. He never won any titles. He never even competed for any titles. Again, putting Jerry Lawler as high as he is on this list ahead of somebody like Hogan, to me, it's just so petty on their part. Yeah, I try not to get upset about stupid shit like this. Again, this is a meaning... At the end of the day, it's a meaningless fucking bullshit list. But it's just so petty and so stupid. And people are going to be debating this now for weeks and weeks and weeks. And you just have no justification for putting Jerry Lawler at number 19 on this list. He's not top 20 material when it comes to the best that WWE has ever seen. You know, this is a company that has a 50, 60 year history, and Jerry Lawler has done dick in this company, quite frankly. Now, after Lawler, they have Lou Fez, Terry Funk, Hulk Hogan, finally, at number 23. Hulk Hogan at number 23 on this list. Now, say what you want to about Hulk Hogan's working ability, about his ego. Without Hulk Hogan getting over the way he did, WWE likely would not be where they are today. Hogan was a big star wherever he went. When Hulk Hogan wrestled for Vern Gagne in the AWA, he was the biggest star that Vern Gagne had. And what Vern Gagne did was he booked too many dusty finishes where they'd put Hogan in the ring with Nick Bockwinkle, who was their champion, and book it where Hogan looked like he won the belt, but then, of course, he'd get screwed and he didn't actually win the belt. So Hogan never officially won the AWA title, got sick, and left. And that was Vern Gagne's loss, and obviously a big gain for Vince McMahon. So he was a big star in AWA. He was a big star the moment he came back to WWF. He won the title from the Iron Sheik in January of 84. WrestleMania came a year later, and there was no turning back after that. Hogan held the belt the first time for 4 years, made money, and sold out everywhere he went. I mean, these are cold, hard facts here. This cannot be denied. And, you know, he was every bit as an important part of that Hogan-Andre main event at WrestleMania 3 than Andre was. And you've got Andre at number 8. So how you put Hogan at number 23, I mean, we all know why Hogan is number 23, but it's bullshit. Bruno Sammartino, number 24, which is also bullshit. Jericho is 25. Then you have Ted DiBiase, Fabulous Moolah, Fred Blassie, Randy Orton, Pat Patterson, Iron Sheik, Jimmy Snuka, Mick Foley. Then Kurt Angle finally is listed. Buddy Rogers, Gorilla Monsoon, Junkyard Dog, which is fucking bullshit. Junkyard Dog, look... Junkyard Dog's best days were probably in Mid-South, being booked by Bill Watts, okay, in the early to mid-80s. Junkyard Dog in WWF, even though he got over, he definitely got over. The fans were behind him. He fucking sucked. He doesn't belong on a list like this. Junkyard Dog, find me one Junkyard Dog match, in the WWF at least, that was any good at all. That was at least 2.5 stars. I don't think he had one. Billy Graham, Jake Roberts, Big Show, Jack Briscoe, Sergeant Slaughter, Kane, Nick Bockwinkel, can't figure that one out, Jeff Hardy, Dory Funk Jr., Bob Backlund, Rick Rude, Batista, and at number 50, Killer Kowalski, who I think his biggest claim to fame, as big a star as he was in the business, again, if we're talking WWE, I think his biggest claim to fame was probably winning the tag belts under a mask with Big John Studd as the executioners in the 70s. But apparently that makes you the greatest of all time. So, anyway, that's the list. Again, if it is legit, it is a bullshit list. I don't know what the format of the DVD is going to be. They may have some great matches on there. I have not seen an actual track listing for it yet. But this list was clearly made by somebody who was under the influence of drugs and or alcohol. I could come up with a better list in my sleep. I can come up with a better list with the flu in my sleep. So, yeah, this list is an epic fail. Moving on here, the WWE crew is just wrapping up a big European tour, apparently another successful one. Raw was emanating from the UK this past Monday night. Another show that was so great, I only remember one segment from it, and ironically, it was my favorite segment on the entire show, which involved comedy, which just goes to show you that I'm not against comedy when it's done correctly and sparingly. There's still too much of it, but this was fucking great. It was tea time with Santino Marella and Vladimir Kozlov, who came out dressed up as, I guess, Sherlock Holmes and his partner. And they came to the ring. There was a whole setup with tea and crumpets and milk and sugar and all that crap. And they invited Sheamus, or as Santino would say, Sheamus, out for some tea time. And Santino was on fucking fire this week. And actually, the last couple of weeks, he's been phenomenal. So Santino invites Sheamus out. Sheamus takes a seat. And basically, the gist of it was that Santino was supposedly, unintentionally, cracking jokes on Sheamus about his pale pigmentation and that sort of thing, and was kind of getting under his skin. But even Sheamus was just trying as hard as he possibly could not to bust a gut laughing, and at one point he turned around and said, "You know, Santino, I like you. I forgot even why I was upset with you in the first place." And Santino was like, "I can't remember why you were angry with me either." And that's when Kozlov piped up in his great accent, basically said, "Well, because you beat Sheamus a couple of weeks ago in the biggest upset in WWE history." And then he smirked. And for the first time, perhaps ever, there was a Kozlov chant. Only in the UK. This was a phenomenal crowd, in case you couldn't tell. And again, it goes to show you how much a good hot crowd can really make a segment go from either okay or good to fucking great, which is what this was. And once Kozlov reminded Sheamus that Santino had beaten him 2 weeks earlier, that made him very angry. Santino was very nervous, accidentally spilled tea all over his crotch. The crowd went crazy. This led to a very forgetful match. It wasn't about the match. Who cares? This segment was gold. This was easily the best part of Monday Night Raw. Santino was fucking awesome. I cannot remember a single thing from this show. Part of that, I'm sure, is in my my medicated days right now. It's a little hard for me to remember much from this past week. But all you need to know is that if you didn't see Raw, or even if you did, go back and watch that segment. It's a great way to put a smile on one's face. And if you want to wipe that smile away, then just watch the rest of Raw. I put on Impact long enough on Thursday to see Jeff Hardy parading around with the Divas Championship. So I'm not quite sure what that was about. But apparently he has his own world championship in the same vein that Steve Austin once had his Smoking Skull title, and John Cena had his Spinner belt, which unfortunately became the championship in WWE, and we have still not been able to rid ourselves of that belt, even though it doesn't spin anymore. So Jeff Hardy has his own belt that does very much look like the WWE Divas belt. And, you know, hey, if I was going to have a belt made in my company, I cannot think of a better title to mimic than the ugliest fucking belt in the history of WWE. Actually, I shouldn't say that. I should say the second, because those tag team belts are like... Actually, I've had people write to me, and I agree with them, that the new tag team titles on Raw look like giant pennies, which is actually quite true. It's quite accurate. They do look like two giant pennies. They're quite ugly. I don't know what's going on with wrestling belts these days. They're quite disgusting. I wish that we would just be able to go back to the way they used to be. I'm not always the biggest fan of just going back to the way things were. You know, I'm a big fan of coming up with new things and stuff like that. But you know what? In this case, just bring back the old belts. Come on. Let's bring back the Winged Eagle. Anyway, Impact, I didn't see much more than that. I could not stomach it. Another shit show based on the results that I read. But I'm not going to comment beyond that because I didn't watch it for myself. I'll trust that people know what they're talking about when they say that Impact sucked. Actually, our buddy Sky did send in his own Impact report here. So I guess I should just go through this real quick. Kind of the big things that happened on Thursday night. Team 3D, who was supposed to retire. I don't think anybody in the world actually believed that that would happen. Team 3D came out and basically Bubba turned on D-Von, attacked him from behind. And it was quite embarrassing because the crowd did not give a shit about any of this. There was practically no reaction whatsoever. And it's because nobody cares. First of all, most people probably saw this coming from a mile away. And even if they didn't, we've seen so many of these pointless swerves and meaningless turns. They don't mean anything. And they just don't, they don't get that. They do them anyway because they think they're shocking people. Well, I guess the crowd was so shocked, they were silent. They were shocked into silence. So there you go. Pope, let's see here, took Eric Bischoff hostage. I think Impact is setting a record for the most number of hostage takers in wrestling and kidnappings. You would think that they would do something to address this problem, perhaps beef up security beyond just Gunnar and Murphy, but I guess they just really don't care. It was a match between RVD and Kazarian, which I mentioned only because of something that apparently happened on Reaction. I did not see this myself. I did have one person write in that apparently during Reaction, I don't remember what segment, you could clearly in the background see RVD and Kazarian going over their match. Which, good job, TNA. Good job. Actually, what that reminds me of is in WWF back in 99. You may remember they used to do the live Sunday Night Heat pre-shows before the pay-per-views. And at SummerSlam that year was the big match between The Rock and Billy Gunn. And I vividly remember that on the pre-show, I'm pretty sure it would have been Heat. I guess it could have been the free-for-all, but it probably was Sunday Night Heat. There was some sort of backstage segment. I think maybe it was an interview with somebody or the announcer was doing a stand-up. But clearly in the background, you could see The Rock and Billy Gunn going over their match, which I thought was quite comical at the time. So this was kind of similar, but that was live. This was not. Reaction is not a live show. In fact, it's highly, highly produced and edited. And so therefore is no excuse for bullshit like that. So way to go, TNA. Way to go. Anyway, I guess the main event was Matt Morgan against Beer Money and Doug Williams, and I don't know who won. All I know is that Matt Morgan is getting a rematch with Jeff Hardy. Another pay-per-view main event featuring Jeff Hardy and Matt Morgan. This is a company that apparently is allergic to money. I didn't think that was possible, but I guess TNA, they are truly allergic to making money. Otherwise, I have no idea why they would book this match again. If Mr. Anderson is not ready to come back from his concussion, I could think of five other guys who at the very least would have a much better match with Jeff Hardy than Matt fucking Morgan. Anyway, one other piece of TNA news here. Apparently, Lacey Von Erich is on her way out of TNA. She posted on her Twitter a couple of days ago that she was going to be leaving to pursue other things, like possibly becoming a TV sports host or some, I don't know, some bullshit like that. So apparently, that's more important to her than being a part of TNA. I can't say that I blame her. Nor can I say that this is going to be a huge loss for TNA. I'm not going to sit here and say that they're losing a tremendous talent, because obviously they're not. But they're losing a hell of a trainer. Remember? believe it was Lacey Von Erich who they said was down training Miss Tessmacher to become a wrestler. Scary and frightening as that was. So I guess Miss Tessmacher will have to find a suitable replacement as her trainer. By the way, speaking of Twitter, this was my funny laugh-out-loud moment of the week. I don't know, it should still be up. Harry Smith has a Twitter. I believe I'm following him, so if you don't know what the direct... If you can't find the direct link to his Twitter, just look it up on there. You can probably find it. And he tends to post cell phone pictures whenever there's like a guest host or, you know, he's around somebody famous. And I guess from 2 weeks ago, when Pee Wee Herman hosted Raw, I think I had mentioned that a lot of the boys in the back were very excited to see Pee Wee. A lot of them grew up around the same time that Pee Wee was big on TV and his movie came out and all that stuff. So there's a picture of Harry Smith posing with Pee Wee Herman backstage. And in the background, in this photo, there is a door to one of the rooms backstage. And next to the door on the wall is a picture. And it basically says writer's room, and above that, or next to it, next to the text that says writer's room, is a picture of William Shakespeare. Because you see, this is the WWE writer's room, and thus, this is a picture of Shakespeare, because the two are so alike. That's what they're doing in that room. They're writing Shakespearean storylines. I had such a fucking laugh when I saw that picture. I want you all to go and find the link and just laugh your ass off when you see that. Just the irony of that photo. Just the irony of seeing the WWE writer's room with a picture of Shakespeare. I fucking died when I saw that. There was video that went up on YouTube this week at one of the European shows. William Regal was working mostly with Daniel Bryan. I'm sorry I wasn't there to see those matches. But apparently the big story was that William Regal announced that he was going to be retiring, and this was going to be his last European tour. And first of all, I watched the video. Not one time did William Regal say anything about retiring. So I don't know where people got that from. But if you actually watch the video and listen to what he has to say, all he's saying is that this could potentially be his last European tour. So yes, it's possible that he could retire one of these days, but he did not outright say that he was going to be retiring. Now, I think it was last week I came on here and I announced there was a nugget in one of the newsletters that talked about the fact that Regal had just signed a 42-month extension on his WWE contract. That is accurate. And even if Regal does wind down the in-ring part of his career, you know, the reason for that extension, WWE wants to keep him around. Once he is done in the ring, one of two things will happen. Regal will either become a trainer and probably go down to FCW, or he'll become a backstage road agent. So, because people saw the video, thought that he was retiring, they thought automatically that the contract renewal story was bullshit. What is bullshit is how people are interpreting that video. Because again, he does not say he is retiring. He says, this could be my last European tour. There's a big fucking difference. You're putting words in the man's mouth. Go back and watch the video if it's not already taken down. He did not say that he is retiring. And if he does retire within the next, let's say, 6 months to a year, he's not going anywhere. He's going to still be with the company, he'll be contributing backstage, or he'll be training people. Which is actually not the worst thing in the world, because Regal is a hell of a trainer. Just look at Bryan Danielson. Orlando is pushing for a WWE Hall of Fame building in their city. I think one of the things, when I covered the Hall of Fame part of my WWE business plan, in the often referenced episode 127 of this very podcast, I talked about the company investing the money in putting together an actual Hall of Fame facility, and that doing so, if they were to do so, would make sense in a tourist destination. New York City comes to mind, and other places like Orlando, because you have Orlando, I don't know where it ranks as compared to a New York or a Vegas It's got to be up there as far as worldwide tourist destinations are concerned. You've got Universal Studios, you've got Disney World. It would not be the worst place in the world to do something like that, but again, it has to be economically feasible. I had a lot of people write into me after I did that podcast saying, you know, this is all pie in the sky, it doesn't make any sense for them to do that, and you may well be right. You know, you may well be right. NASCAR, I believe, first opened up their own Hall of Fame building within the last year or two, and from what I understand, they have actually lost money on that. WWE is not in a position where they need to be losing money on anything. So it has to be economically feasible, but apparently the city of Orlando is taking it upon themselves. They're putting together some sort of proposal, and they're going to bring that proposal to WWE within the next couple of weeks. So I don't know what the details of this proposal will be. I don't know if they plan on contributing to the construction of such a facility. I mean, if they were to, you know, if they were going to take on some of the cost of a project like this, I'm WWE, I'm certainly ready, willing, and able to listen to that offer. And again, Orlando would have to be one of the top three target places for them to do something like this. But we'll see. I was a little caught off guard by that. I know people are bidding on WrestleMania now. Cities are bidding on WrestleMania, but this is the first I've heard of a city actively lobbying to have the Hall of Fame built in their city, which is kind of interesting. All right, let's get into the mailbag here. Before I do that, just two quick notes here for two of our listeners. Mario from Egypt, if you are listening, and Tori Gallagher as well, your email accounts have been hacked. So you're going to have that taken care of, because I cannot open emails from either one of you guys until you have that situation fixed. So again, Tori and then Mario from Egypt, if you are listening, your email accounts have been hacked and your emails will not be read until that gets fixed. Or if you want to start using an alternate email address, that would be fine too. So I just wanted to point that out. And on that note, let's go into the mailbag here. We have our first letter here from India. Sarab, one of our listeners, just a quick note regarding what you said on the last sound off. Chris Jericho and Edge did have a rematch on pay-per-view after WrestleMania this year. In fact, it was a steel cage match at Extreme Rules. Just goes to show how stale and depleted WWE storylines have become, that certain fans don't remember a steel cage match. Well, that is true. I have absolutely no recollection of that whatsoever. And I want to thank all the people, because he was not the only person who wrote in to point that out to me, so just a quick thank you to everybody who wrote in. I completely forgot about the fact that they had that cage match, and that Jack Swagger had cashed in his Money in the Bank and beaten Chris Jericho for the title on SmackDown. It just completely slipped my mind. Let's see. Derek from Missouri, listener since episode 1. My question, Solomon Monster, is, do you think that since the John Cena heel turn is going to be so over, do I believe that the John Cena heel turn, when and if it actually happens, that people will actually like him, since he already gets a lot of boos now anyway? Might the reaction be, I guess essentially what he's saying is, will the reaction be ass backwards? If John Cena turns heel, is he suddenly going to start to get cheered and respected by the fans? Well, you know, it's certainly possible. You know, if you have enough quote-unquote smart fans out there who want to fuck with whatever WWE is doing, it could happen. I think it would be kind of funny, actually, if it did happen that way. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, when John Cena turns heel, if they do it the right way, he won't get cheered. And if they do it half-assed, then he will. But if you do a heel turn the right way and you can get people to hate you and you can get people to boo you, that means you're being a good heel, and you're not going to have to worry about getting cheered. So, really, the ball is in their court, in John Cena's court. If they can do a good job, then they won't have to worry about that. And if they want him to be a cool heel like Kevin Nash, well, then he'll get cheered. Got a letter from Edgar. Dear Solomonster, I want to know your take on Raven and Sabu being released from TNA. What do you think about this? I you know what, I don't really care, quite frankly. I have a lot of respect for what both guys have accomplished in their careers, especially Sabu. Sabu has quite literally given his body for the business, and I respect that. But Raven and Sabu are past their prime. Their time has come and gone. And the fact is, they were never going to move the needle in TNA. They're not going to move the needle in WWE. And, you know, if I'm running either company, I'm only focusing on guys that can actually do business for me. So, Sabu and Raven got a big break that they probably should be thankful they got. Because if it wasn't for them coming up with the whole EV2 storyline and all that crap and the ECW Hardcore Justice reunion, they never would have been brought back in the first place. And if I had to keep one over the other, I'd probably keep Sabu, because Raven just looks atrocious to me. I mean, I know Raven has been through a lot. He's a recovering addict and all that. Raven looks literally like a walking corpse. I mean, if you watch The Walking Dead on AMC, which is a great show, by the way, Raven looks not unlike one of the zombies that walks around. He looks fucking terrible. Sabu looks better than Raven, doesn't exactly move around as well as he used to, which, of course, is to be expected. But again, great. I feel great for Sabu that he's been getting a couple of paydays since August when TNA brought him back. And the fact that now that he's gone, it was kind of shitty, I think, the way they handled the whole thing. But Sabu wasn't doing business for TNA. He wasn't really making a mark. He's just taking up a roster spot. He had his chance. He had another moment in the sun. And now he's finished. He's done. And if somebody else wants to give him an opportunity, then more power to him. But I don't really know that he has much left to give, quite frankly. Greg writes in, "Dear Solomonster, I was listening to episode 127 again, and I was wondering if you had control of WWE, would you ever do a Mr. McMahon-type heel character? Would love to hear your thoughts about that." If I had control of WWE, and as per episode 127, I could sign even half the talent that I listed from TNA and ROH, my main focus would be showcasing those stars and getting them over to the audience, not putting myself or some other authority figure on TV in every fucking segment like Eric Bischoff is doing right now in TNA. I think he is literally in every single segment. Now, that being said, you know, after a little while, if I thought that a character like that would make a great antagonist for a babyface that I was trying to push, then absolutely. I mean, that the Mr. McMahon character is as much responsible for the boom period of the late 90s as Steve Austin. It's kind of similar to Rowdy Roddy Piper, not getting enough credit for being a foil to Hulk Hogan during the Rock and Wrestling era. And if I thought it was going to help business like it did once before, then I don't see why I wouldn't try something like that. You know, it has helped business before. It can again. The problem is it's just done way too often these days. So I would want to give that whole character a rest. And after a while, if I thought it would be prudent to do so, then sure. I would certainly look into having a character like that. Tony writes in, "We both know that TNA will not become competition to WWE. And I only started watching Ring of Honor on YouTube this past week. They have a great roster of talent. Do you think ROH should try getting onto cable TV to build a larger audience?" Well, I hate to break it to you, Tony, but they're already on cable TV. They are on HDNet, 8 o'clock every Monday night. Now, obviously, HDNet is not as widely available as a USA Network or a Spike TV. So if you mean trying to get on a bigger cable channel, you know, in theory, that would be great, but it's not so simple. You know, they can't just pick and choose the cable channel that they want to go on. Unfortunately, wrestling is not nearly as hot as it was a decade ago. You know, and even a decade ago, you couldn't just pick and choose the cable channel on which your programming would air. Quite frankly, Ring of Honor is, they're losing money, but they've made some cutbacks recently to the point where they're not losing as much. They might even be turning a small profit right now, but they were losing money before. And it's kind of similar to TNA in that they're being backed by an individual who is willing to finance the organization. But again, you just ask yourself, at what point do your priorities change? You know, in terms of Ring of Honor, it's one person. It's one guy, Kari Silken. He is the lifeblood of Ring of Honor. He is the one pumping money into Ring of Honor. He is the one that when Ring of Honor is losing money, he is losing money. And it's a little bit different in that Carrie, I don't know how rich Carrie Silkin is. He's not a multi-millionaire, I don't think. So it's very different from TNA in that TNA is being backed by Bob Carter, whose family is in fact worth many millions of dollars. But at its core, it's the same basic concept here. Nobody wants to lose money, and at some point something's got to give. I made a comment last week in passing that TNA to this point has lost in the range of $45 million, which is true. Ring of Honor has not lost that much money, but at the same time, their operating costs and the size and scope of their organization is obviously a lot smaller than even TNA. Ring of Honor has a tremendous roster of talent, and it would be nice if more people had exposure to the product. But again, when you deal with a bigger network, I mean, look at the original ECW. You know, people thought that when ECW got on TNN, okay, the Nashville network, that was their big break. This is the big break that Paul Heyman and ECW were looking for. And what ended up happening was that TV deal ended up killing ECW because things didn't work out the way that they were supposed to, and ultimately they got kicked off the network in favor of WWE. Essentially, what we later found out was that TNN was using ECW as kind of a litmus test on how wrestling would perform on their network. WWE's deal with USA was coming up, and so TNN saw the writing on the wall and said, hey, here's our chance. Wrestling doesn't do too bad for us. Let's pick up the big number one brand, bring them over to our network, and kick ECW to the curb. And that's essentially what happened. So, you know, when you get in bed with a big network like that, you're also kind of taking your own life into your hands. I think Ring of Honor likes where they are right now. They have a TV deal, but they don't necessarily want a bigger TV deal because they still make a lot of their money off their DVD sales and the internet pay-per-views that they host a couple of times each year. So if you have a TV show on Spike TV all of a sudden, which is available in over 90 million homes, as opposed to HDNet, which doesn't even keep track of their own ratings anymore, you know, how is that going to impact DVD sales? Because you may have a sweet TV deal, but you're not making money off that, necessarily, the way that you are off DVD merchandise sales. So you got to take all those things into account. And I just don't know that Ring of Honor is ready to kind of get to that point just yet. So that's going to do the mailbag for this week. As always, you can submit questions, comments, and anything else you want to thesolemonster at gmail.com. Twitter.com/solemonster. You can follow me on there and friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/thesolemonster, all one word. And hopefully, by the time we come back with 135 next week, I will be back at 100% because I could tell you that this sucks. I've not felt like myself all week and still don't. Hopefully that will change very, very soon. One thing I forgot to mention, actually, it was right after last week's show. I think that night, actually, I got around to seeing Steve Austin's new straight-to-DVD flick, Hunt to Kill, and I enjoyed it. I really did. It was fine for what it was. It was basically an action movie in the mountains, and it's exactly what you would think it is. Steve Austin is not the master thespian that Dwayne Johnson is, but he's fine in roles like this when it comes to just very little dialogue and just general ass-kicking and shooting and things of that nature. The main antagonist in the movie, I forgot his name, he's a known actor, but to me he's best known for being the prisoner in the Shawshank Redemption that Tim Robbins' character kind of mentors, and you kind of come to like the guy, and then the poor bastard gets killed in the middle of the movie by one of the warden's men. I don't remember his real name, but he's kind of the main bad guy in the movie, and you just look at him act compared to, like, Steve Austin, and you can just tell who has the more acting experience. But I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it for what it was, and so if anybody out there who is following the film career of Stone Cold is interested in seeing the movie, Hunt to Kill, I give it a thumbs up. It's like I said, exactly what you would think it would be. No better, no worse. Although I will say that the actress that plays Steve Austin's daughter in the movie is ungodly hot. And I have no doubt in my mind that in real life, Steve Austin would just love to be all over that. So, anyway. Thumbs up on Hunt to Kill. And we'll be back next week with episode 135 of the Sound Off. That would be Survivor Series weekend. I just realized I didn't talk about Survivor Series at all, but not much else to talk about as far as the pay-per-view is concerned. The go-home Raw this week is the three-hour old-school edition of Monday Night Raw. It kicks off at 8 p.m. on Monday night. They've already announced a whole bunch of guests. Mean Gene Okerlund will be there, as well as Dusty Rhodes, Ted DiBiase, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Sergeant Slaughter, Mae Young, the Iron Sheik, Nikolai Volkoff, and a couple of other people. I'm hoping they have some surprises up their sleeve. I know the Honky Tonk Man is claiming that he was invited and then he's not going to be there because of some, you know, probably a money dispute with WWE. Who gives a shit? I hope they have a surprise or two up their sleeves, just because as much as I love to see all of those guys, you know, we just saw DiBiase and Dusty on NXT last week, and all those other guys like Duggan and Mae Young and The Sheik, we see them every fucking time that WWE does a show like this. Even Rowdy Roddy Piper. You know, who doesn't want to see Hot Rod? He'll be there on Monday night, but we see the same guys every single time. Let's throw some new guys out there. Let's put a name or two in the hat that we haven't seen in many, many years. Let's put Macho Man on commentary with Vince McMahon. Let's really shake things up a little bit here. Supposedly, they're going to actually have the classic old-school Monday Night Raw intro from 1993, and they're going to have very little pyro. They may have the sirens. I don't even know. Maybe the set will look different, too. I'm actually most interested in that. But it is the go-home show to the pay-per-view. So as much as I'm very much looking forward to the old-school aspect of this show, they've got 3 hours to announce more than just three fucking matches for this pay-per-view and get people interested in ordering the Survivor Series. So that really should be their primary goal on Monday night. I just think it's bad timing to do a gimmick show like this the week before your big fall pay-per-view. So we'll see what they got up their sleeve. Like I said, they better have a surprise or two, because I'm not overly impressed by the roster of old school talent they've got lined up for us. So that's going to do it from here. Till next time, be well, unlike me. Stay safe, and thanks for supporting the Sound Off.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster Sounds Off on ScoopsScoops.com.